Okay, good morning. So before your lunch today, I would like to present two works we have done in collaboration with David Absalom and Florian Meyer here at UCSB, and also with Guido Burkhardt, Veronica Celletti, and Daniel Loos at the University of Basel. Let's see if I remember how to do it. Okay, so the first topic I would like to talk about is the transfer of entanglement from electron spins to photons, which is a topic related to the spin optic issue. And so more calculational details can be found in mainly these two works and also my thesis, which is available online. So first of all, as a motivation, why is that interesting to transfer entanglement from spins to photons? So the idea lying in the background here is the conversion of a localized qubit, in this case a spin qubit, into a flying photon qubit. And that's, as you all know very well, so a spin qubit can be manipulated rather well, while a photon qubit propagates, first of all, very fast, and second, interacts very weakly with other qubits or with the environment. And another experimental issue is that photon entanglement is probably easier to detect experimentally than spin entanglement directly. And so there have recently been many proposals for devices, which I depict here as a black box, which provide non-local entangled electrons, which are entangled in the spin degree of freedom. And so our idea is to propose a setup where such entanglers could be tested. And another motivation for this work is that solid-state structures promise or let people dream of having an efficient and essentially a deterministic source of entangled photons, which is interesting for quantum information applications. And I will try to convince you that such a structure would not only enable the production of entangled two-photon states, but also entangled four-photon states. Okay, and so there's a huge list of proposals for electron spin entanglers. And this list is maybe not even complete. And essentially, an electron entangler provides a pair of non-local spin entangled electrons. And a source of entangled electrons is, for example, the interacting ground state of two electrons in a quantum dot or in a double dot. And then a tunnel process would separate the individual electrons. The tunneling could be, for example, via a third quantum dot. Another source of spin singlets are, of course, Cooper pairs in a S-wave superconductor. And there are several proposals how a Cooper pair could be separated, for example, via an Andreev tunneling process, or via tunneling into Luttinger liquid leads, or also by tunneling into a normal lead, taking into account a dynamical Coulomb blockade, which tends to separate the two electrons. And another process which has been proposed is to have electrons scatter, for example, in a two-dimensional electron gas structure. And when electrons scatter at the right angle, then they are in a spin singlet. But this is just to introduce the motivation of our work. The main ingredient of our proposal are the so-called spin LEDs, which enable the detection of electron spin polarization by measuring the photon polarization in the electroluminescence. So carriers are injected electrically, and the emitted light is measured. And there have been experiments with spin LEDs containing quantum dots, which essentially gives access to the recombination of individual electron hole pairs. And recently, there was also an experiment using quantum dots with positively charged quantum dots. And this is what we are especially interested in, so having an additional positive charge in the quantum dot. An important experimental result which we rely on here is that the electron injection and the subsequent orbital relaxation through the quantum dot levels of the injected electrons occurs much faster than the optical recombination time. And most important, it has been shown to be spin conserving to a very large degree. And so if we now look at, for example, the Andreev entangler proposed by Lecho et al., we see that essentially we have now a separation of time scales. So the production rate of an entangled electron pair in this proposal is such that there is like one entangled pair every 10 microseconds, more or less, while the possible delay within the entangled electron pair is given by the superconducting gap where the spin singlet comes from, and this is very small. And so if we consider now, for example, ballistic transport of two electrons into quantum dots in a spin LED, we have then injection of the electrons in orbital relaxation, which, as I mentioned before, has been shown to be on the order of 10 picoseconds, and the optical recombination then takes about 1 nanosecond. And so this means that if we look at these timescales in an experiment, we may consider the time evolution of a single pair at a time. So there's no intermixing of photons from one pair and another pair. And so we have, this is just a minor thing, so we have looked at the injection process and solved the master equation for the classical occupation probabilities. And we see that mainly the probability that two photons are emitted is essentially given by the bottleneck here, which is the optical recombination process. Of course, there's also spin dynamics going on. And here I'm talking about spin dynamics after the injection of the entangled electrons into some leads up to the recombination. So first of all, there can be precession of the spins around different external magnetic fields or effective magnetic fields due to the spin-orbit interaction. And the spin-orbit interaction can be, at least the Rochefort type of spin-orbit interaction, can be controlled externally. And it has been proposed in these works here that actually one can have different effective magnetic fields in the two leads. And one can actually rotate the singlet into another maximally entangled Bell state. Of course, there's also spin relaxation and decoherence going on, which we have taken into account here in a phenomenological Bloch model. And we have looked at the time dependence of the two-spin density matrix. But we can then calculate, for example, the fidelity of the singlet here, but I'm not going to show this here. The main point I want to make is that when the transportation times of the two singlets, of the two electrons, are much shorter than the spin lifetimes, then we may assume that we still have an entangled spin state. And remember that the T2 star of spins in Gallium-arsenide bulk has been measured to be 100 nanoseconds. And if you assume ballistic transport here and the wire length of maybe 1 micron, then we see that the transportation time at the Fermi velocity is tens of picoseconds. So this satisfies this criterion here. And we rely on this property here. Okay, and now I'll come to the optical recombination process. And we have already heard in previous talks, some details of this. And let me just remind you here of the band structure. So we are thinking about, for example, gallium arsenide, which is a 3-5 semiconductor with a zinc blend structure. And we have a conduction band here, and we have here the valence band. The conduction band having an S wave function, valence band having a P wave function, which couples with the spin to an angular momentum 3/2 or 1/2 manifold. And we have here the heavy hole band and the light hole band. And the main statement I want to make here is that when there is strong spatial confinement along one axis, typically the growth axis of the quantum dots, or uniaxial strain plays the same role, then there is a splitting of heavy and light holes, which are usually degenerate in the bulk. And the typical magnitude of this splitting is 10 millielectron volts for gallium arsenide and also indium arsenide quantum dots.
It's not completely correct, I think, the band structure. This is to be in a quantum well or not?
This is for a quantum well.
Yeah, then I guess the order of the heavy hole and the light hole should be
open. That depends on the sign of the strain, for example.
In the quantum well, like fine.
Okay.
And then you get hybridization between the light and heavy hole because they cross.
Okay, maybe this is only valid for a very small case where we have parabolic parabolic dispersion relation.
Well, no, because in the z direction, what is heavy hole in the z direction is light hole in the parallel direction. Right? So the low energy state, which is a heavy hole in the z direction, has a dispersion in the plane, which is corresponding to light. That just gives you a valence band, mixing and stuff.
Okay. I'm not sure if I completely understand your point. Maybe let's talk about k equals zero. And there we have a splitting of heavy and light hole state.
Yes, but if then you look at the mass in k parallel, it's lighter for the heavy hole than for the light hole. But okay, let's
yeah, heavy hole is larger, and so it is higher in energy. So this is not in the whole picture. Yeah, okay. okay, the point I wanted to make is that we are restricting our considerations on heavy holes. And the transitions are usually circular. And okay, for quantum dots, we take now a simplified model. So first of all, we need to be at a low temperature. And second, we require quantum dots with a circular shape, such that the angular momentum is a good quantum number. And now a question for the entanglement transfer is, how does an exciton spin translate into a photon polarization? And again, so I'm neglecting here mixing of heavy and light holes for a second. If you have an ideal two-dimensional quantum dot with a circular shape, then the exciton spin quantization axis is typically the direction of the strongest confinement, which is the z direction in my case here. And this is defined by the valence band, because the valence band states are split in the z because of the confinement in z direction. On the other hand, the photon has a quantization axis, if you wish, for the circular polarization, which is defined along its propagation direction. And this means that a photon, which is emitted from, for example, a plus one exciton, has a polarization which also depends on its emission angles. And the emission angles I define as spherical angles in the cubic crystal structure. So I'm considering here a crystal with cubic symmetry. And so theta is the angle to the quantization axis, and phi is the azimuthal angle with respect to a crystal axis. And you see that the azimuthal angle just gives a global phase for a single photon state, while the angle theta controls the admixture of sigma plus or sigma minus. And so essentially for emission parallel to the quantization axis, we have a one-to-one correspondence between exciton spin and circular polarization. When there is a finite angle theta, we have an admixture of the two circular polarizations. And this polarization is called elliptical polarization. When the photon is emitted perpendicular to the quantization axis of spin, then the photon is linearly polarized. And essentially, it is the same linear polarization for both exciton states. And this has an effect on the entanglement, which is observable by the photon. And as Professor Sham pointed out on Tuesday, so when there is light hole mixing, we get some additional, let's say, for example, we have a plus one exciton. And for heavy holes, we would just get a sigma plus photon. If there is a light hole contribution, you would have some extra contribution to this factor here, because light holes give rise to the opposite polarization, and therefore the admixture of light holes can be considered like a tilting of the quantization axis. But for our purposes at the moment, let's consider only theta equals zero. I will discuss later on what happens at different angles. And for this configuration, we may expect a phaseful conversion of exciton spin into circular photon polarization, and therefore reliable entanglement transfer is possible in principle. And a demonstration of this property has been given recently, where it has been shown experimentally that a biexciton in a ground state, which decays via a cascade to a single exciton state and to an empty quantum dot, that these two photons here are entangled in polarization. And here you see the density matrices which demonstrate entanglement of the two photons. And I want to, as a brief intermission, I want to talk about the situation of the bi-exciton, because it is also relevant to our structure. So
is this really an entangled state? Because you're not taking into account when you do the photon, the two photons that comes out of different frequencies.
Right, yeah. It's entangled in only in the polarization degree of freedom.
Yeah, but
Not in this case. It's entanglement of polarization. I will come to this in two slides.
Okay.
But let me first make a brief comment. So you will notice that between the proposal and the experimental realization, there has been a large time, and there have been problems actually related to what Professor Ram is pointing out. And the problem is that quantum dots are usually not circular, but they are rather elliptical. For example, gallium arsenide dots, these natural quantum dots, or self-assembled indium arsenide dots. And it has been shown theoretically, and is also known from many experiments, that the exciton ground state decays in a doublet of two linearly polarized excitons, which I call vertical and linear polarized here. And the lifting of the exciton spin degeneracy is the main problem why entanglement could not be shown for the bi-exciton decay cascade for so long time. So the splitting is on the order of 10 to 100 micro EV. And yes, I don't want to talk about this in more detail because it's not really necessary. So what happens for the bi-exciton decay cascade? So we have here the two exciton states, which are split in energy by our electron hole exchange splitting. And so if we write the bi-exciton ground state down in the basis of horizontal and vertically polarized excitons, then we find that it is a superposition of horizontal-horizontal minus vertical-vertical. And if everything went fine, one photon would be emitted, and the photon would be entangled with the remaining exciton on the dot. And after some time later, the second photon would be emitted, and this would be the state we get. However, now, if this intermediate exciton state is split, so first of all, what happens is that the photons are not only entangled in polarization, but also in energy, because H and V, they have different energies, these photons here. And so do the excitons here. And this spin splitting of the exciton also opens relaxation channels. So polarization may relax, and every relaxation channel contributes to decoherence, meaning that the superposition of a photon entangled with an exciton has a finite lifetime, which is limited by the exciton decoherence time. And this means that typically one doesn't get this state here, but a classically correlated two-photon state. And this is the result of many experiments so far. And the achievement which has been made now is mainly in the growth of the quantum dots. And then these people were able to identify quantum dots which have a splitting which is smaller than the homogeneous line width of the exciton, which is about 1.5 micro EV. And so this means that they have found quantum dots which actually have degenerate exciton spin state. And so maybe to come back to your question, so if there is a splitting, then there is also an entanglement in energy. Here, we only have an entanglement in polarization when we have degenerate exciton states. It is true that these two photons have different energies, but this doesn't disturb the entanglement in the polarization degree of freedom. Okay, and we can say now for our proposal, to remind you to come back to our initial proposal, we have a spin entangler, and we want to have the electrons recombine in different spin LEDs. So if we have quantum dots of this type, then one could imagine that these electrons should be injected into quantum dots where the unpolarized hole is present, and the electrons will recombine, satisfying the polarization selection rules, and entangled photons would be emitted as well from a singlet. And this is actually very similar to a bi-exciton, because a bi-exciton in the strong confinement picture also consists of an electron singlet and an antisymmetric combination of the hole states. And actually, we have found that it is also possible to produce an entangled four-photon state using such a setup. And we have to think about this idea. So if we prepare a single quantum dot in each spin LED here, and so this proposal is based on a single quantum dot spin LED in on the left and on the right hand side. And so in the spin LED, this is a PIN structure typically, where one can inject carriers by applying a suitable bias voltage. And we envision that one could, thanks to the Coulomb blockade effect, prepare a quantum dot with two excess heavy holes in the beginning. And so the heavy holes in the ground state will form an antisymmetric combination, which I call here a pseudo singlet. Pseudo because it's not a spin 1/2. If now in the second step, these entangled electrons are injected into these two quantum dots, the photons 1 and 2 will be emitted because, so this is a transition from a positively charged exciton, an electron with two holes, to a state where there is one hole left in the dot. And let's assume for the moment that the emission is parallel to the spin quantization axis. And so satisfying the polarization selection rules, we find that from the left dot, the total state is a superposition which looks like this. Sigma plus photon from left dot minus 3/2 hole remaining in left dot, and the opposite configuration in the right dot, minus sigma minus photon from left dot plus 3/2 hole left on left dot, and the opposite configuration on the right dot. And now from these holes one could obtain photons by injecting another set of two electrons. And so ideally, if these electrons have spins polarized in the plane, such that spin up and spin down are available for the recombination, then we are able to extract or to have photons 3 and 4 emitted. In principle, it's also possible to inject just another pair of entangled electrons. But I will discuss in a second what this changes a sign, this changes a phase. And I would like to mention that this state here has also a finite lifetime, given by the whole, essentially by the whole spin decoherence time. And the whole spin relaxation and decoherence times depend strongly on many parameters, for example, the geometry of the dot. And this has been studied, for example, in this work here. But there is a regime where the whole spin relaxation time is larger than the spin relaxation time. And because valence band states have no hyperfine coupling, the whole spin decoherence time is essentially given by the relaxation time. Okay, and the final photon state obtained is here. And this is of the Greenberger-Horn Zeilinger type, because it's an n-particle state, a superposition of two orthogonal n-particle states. And okay, this is briefly. So if we don't have a singlet which is injected, but maybe a triplet, or the entangled, or the other two Bell states, the entangled polarized triplet state, we also get a four-photon state of GHZ type. And here I can say that when two entangled pairs are injected instead of the entangled pair plus the polarized pair, then this plus minus just goes to a plus here. And now here comes an advantage of this scheme. So it means more experimental effort, but there is also some gain. And the gain is it works also if we have asymmetric quantum dots, and we can, from this four-photon state, we can gain an entangled, a maximal entangled two-photon state. Even if we have asymmetric quantum dots, which have this exciton spin degeneracy lifted. So what happens if this is the case? So photon 1 and 2 have been from a X-plus transition. And in leading order, this state has zero exchange splitting because the holes are in a JZ equals 0 state. So photon 1 and 2 will be circularly polarized. Photon 3 and 4 are linearly polarized. So we will not get this state here, but we will rather get, sorry, I hope you can see this. We will get, so photon 1 and 2 is, as I mentioned, circularly polarized, and photon 3 and 4 are linearly polarized. This is just by writing, by performing the basis change. And what one could do now is the following. So if you have here our spin LEDs consisting of a single quantum dot, and we have photon 1 and 2 emitted, we propose to use an optical switch where photon 1 and 2 pass through and go through some delay line until photon 3 and 4 are emitted. And subsequently, photon 1 and 2 will be, we undergo a Bell measurement. However, before we do that, we want to project photon 3 and 4 into a horizontally polarized state. And so this means that our optical switch should deviate the photons and guide photon 3 and 4 to a measurement of the linear polarization. And note that because the photon 3 and 4 are emitted from an exciton state, there is actually already a preferential basis given by the quantum dot asymmetry. And even if coherence of these two exciton states would already be lost on the exciton level, this means that we already project the four photon or the mixed two photon two exciton state already into one of these states, because photon 3 and 4 will go out and will be measured. And if you measure horizontal-horizontal, we know that photon 1 and 2 are in disentangled state, or the same if we measure vertical-vertical. However, if you measure horizontal-vertical or vertical-horizontal, we see that we have a different phase between these two states. And so this means that actually the very mechanism which made the production of entangled photons from a bi-exciton impossible actually assists the production of an entangled two-photon state if we take this more complicated state of consisting of two photons and two excitons. Okay, and here I want to talk about geometrical properties of the emission. So assume that we have our maximally entangled two-photon state, which I have mentioned before, and we have seen now, if we take into account the different emission angles of photon 1 and photon 2, we have seen that whenever theta 1 equals theta 2 and the difference of the azimuthal angle is 0, so this means basically that they are emitted into the same direction here, that we get for every angle theta 1 and theta 2 from 0 until pi over 2, but without pi over 2, we get actually this state here. And this is an effect of quantum mechanical interference. And this means that we get 100% entanglement conversion for this continuous set of emission directions, which is kind of a surprising property. As I pointed out before, there's something bad when photons are emitted perpendicular to the spin quantization axis. And this is also visible here, because the destructive interference between these two states is complete, and the two-photon state vanishes. So there will no entangled photons be emitted perpendicular to the quantization axis. And so this can be quantified, this entanglement. And the typical measure for entanglement is the von Neumann entropy, which is just the usual entropy calculated with the reduced density matrix, where one photon is traced out. And to make it brief, so E equals 1 means maximum entanglement, and E equals 0 means that we have not entangled pure state. And so here, this is the von Neumann entropy as a function of the angles theta 1 and theta 2, which were the polar angles. And you see here that whenever theta 1 and theta 2 are identical, that we have E equals 1, maximum entanglement. And here is another situation when we have a right angle between the azimuthal angles. And we have actually seen that as a function of the azimuthal angles, the phenomenal entropy oscillates between these two patterns here. And something important to point out is that in the region close to emission parallel to the quantization axis, entanglement is very large, meaning that even if there is a mixture of light holes, which corresponds to a tilting of the quantization axis, we still are expected to have considerable entanglement. Yes, and again, so whenever one angle is pi over 2, there is zero entanglement. So entanglement is not present for in-plane emission of any one of the photons. Okay, and with this I would like to conclude my first part. So I tried to convince you that spin LEDs could form an efficient interface for entanglement transfer from electron spins to photons. This could be used to test electron spin entanglers. This could also be used to produce quantum states of light, polarization entangled 4, or two-photon states. And essentially, one could also produce entangled two-photon states even with non-ideal quantum dots. And I have shown that there is a continuous set of emission directions where there's 100% fidelity of entanglement transfer. Okay, unless there are any questions, I will just proceed to the second topic. Okay, so I will try to make this brief and maybe skip some part. So this is a recent work we have done in collaboration with Florian Meyer, Danny Loos, and David Ashalom. It has appeared in PRV this year. And so we have studied the dynamics of coupled qubits which additionally interact with a cavity. And so why is this interesting? So first of all, let me introduce what I'm looking at. So a qubit I consider as a pseudo spin 1/2, which can actually also be a real spin 1/2. And this is coupled to a cavity which is off-resonant, which means that its frequency is somewhat smaller than the qubit splitting. And we talk about an off-resonant cavity whenever this detuning is larger than the Rabi frequency of this interacting system. And to give two motivations for looking at such a system, so first of all, it has already experimentally been shown that it is possible to read out the state of a qubit via the AC Stark effect, which means that the cavity frequency will change a bit depending on if the qubit is in the state down or in the state up. And this has been done by the Yale group using superconducting qubits in a strip line resonator. The second motivation is that such a cavity can couple two qubits which are coupled to the cavity. And this effective qubit-qubit interaction provides a two-qubit gate, as has been shown, for example, for electron spin qubits coupled to an optical cavity, or also the same type of superconducting qubits, Cooper pair boxes in a line resonator. And so our motivation now was to go a step further and consider two qubits which are not only coupled to the cavity, but are also directly coupled. And so the Hamiltonian we have taken into account is shown here. So here you have the energy of the qubits, the coupling to the cavity, and the cavity energy. And here we have an additional coupling of the two qubits. And this has the form of a exchange interaction. And if we, for example, look at a system of two spins in a double quantum dot, for example, then one typically assumes that there is Heisenberg interaction, which means that JZ just equals J perp. However, this model is fairly general, and we have seen that it is also applicable to exciton qubits, where the qubit is the zero or the one exciton state, or also, of course, to such Cooper pair box qubits coupled to a cavity. And so let me just briefly talk about some realizations. So one realization, first of all, is, and to go back, is also spin a double dot with two spin 1/2 qubits, which are coupled to a radio frequency cavity. via two photon Raman transitions, one can also couple spin qubits to an optical cavity. This has been shown by Imamoglu and co-workers. And so other realizations we have looked at in more detail in this work are excitons in coupled nanocrystal quantum dots, which are, for example, cadmium selenide nanocrystals with a diameter of nanometers, or excitons in so-called nested quantum shells, which are also nanocrystal structures. They are grown similarly as these nanocrystal quantum dots, but with different materials. And so it is possible to create a potential barrier between two shells. And this is the model system we have looked at. And so we have looked at excitons being in either of these shells or in either of these two dots. To give you a physical picture of what this direct exchange coupling means, J-perp corresponds to coherent exciton transfer either between the dots or between the shells. There's a variety of processes leading to this, but I'm not going to discuss our microscopic calculations in this talk here. JZ, on the other hand, corresponds to an inter-dot or inter-shell bi-exciton shift, which is mainly just the electrostatic interaction of the two excitons. And we have also looked at capacitively coupled Cooper pair boxes in the line resonator. And we can actually show that capacitive coupling can be mapped on our model with the parameter J-perp, setting JZ to zero. And now, so what have we done? So we have performed a Schrieffer-Wolf transformation of this Hamiltonian, transforming away the coupling to the cavity in leading order. And so in this talk, I'm going to focus on identical qubits, meaning that we have identical qubit splitting and identical coupling strength to the cavity. And okay, this is just to show you, to give you some idea of the generator of the Schrieffer-Wolf transformation for this case. It is interesting to see that we have two parts, where each part is related to one transition, and delta plus and delta minus is the detuning of the cavity to one of the allowed two-qubit transitions. I will come to this back in a second. And we have considered a dispersive regime, meaning that the coupling constant times the square root of the photon number, which is the kind of the Rabi frequency, is much smaller than these cavity detunings. And this means that we can consider the coupling to the cavity in terms of perturbation theory. And so we have done an analytical approximation for H prime. And okay, this is just to give you an idea how it looks like. So the first line is just the Hamiltonian we had before, where the coupling to the cavity has been removed in leading order. And these are the extra terms which we get in second order. And so these terms here, don't look at them too close. So they are traditionally called the AC Stark shift and the Lamb shift. AC Stark shift is proportional to the photon number operator. And notably, these states, or this part is diagonal in the dressed single triplet basis. So we are dealing with identical qubits, and therefore we have singlet and triplet eigenstates of the coupled qubits without the coupling to the cavity. And so this part is diagonal in the dressed single triplet state. This third line here corresponds to two photon transitions between the two triplet states, where we have either no excitation in the two-qubit system or two excitations in the two-qubit system. We have also done some more complicated cases, non-identical qubits, and also coupling to the cavity beyond the rotating wave approximation. But I'm not going to discuss this here. So instead, let's have a look at the energy level spectrum. So these are the energy states, or this is the energy spectrum in the subspace when two energy quanta are in the system, which can be either in the cavity field or in the two-qubit system. And these red dashed lines here correspond to our analytical approximation for H prime, which you have seen on the last slide. And as I mentioned before, this approximation is valid in the dispersive regime. Dispersive meaning that we are by a Rabi frequency away from these vertical lines, which are the detunings when the cavity is resonant with one of the triplet transitions of the two-qubit system. And for comparison, we've also shown the exact numerical solution of the states here, which feature anti-crossings of the corresponding triplet levels at these states here. Note that the singlet state is the straight line here. The singlet state decouples completely from the radiation field because of symmetry reasons. This is known, for example, from the Dickey state. And so we have only optical transitions between the triplet states. Note there's also a small anti-crossing here between the triplet states T minus and T plus. And this is due to the two-photon term, which I have pointed out on the last slide. Okay. So as I already mentioned in the introduction, so the most interesting property of the dispersive regime is the AC Stark effect. And the AC Stark effect can be interpreted, on one hand, as a cavity frequency shift, which depends on the 2-qubit state in our case. And note that, so according to the 2-qubit state, there is a different shift of the cavity frequency. For the singlet, it is zero because the singlet decouples from the cavity. And note also that in contrast to decoupled qubits, which are not interacting, a measurement of the cavity frequency would correspond to a projection onto the single triplet basis. This is in contrast to uncoupled qubits, which would just be projected onto a product state, one qubit up, one qubit down, for example. And so, of course, these splittings can only be detected if these splittings are larger than the cavity line width. And okay, another way of looking at the AC Stark effect is to interpret it as a photon number dependent shift of the 2-qubit state. So this here is for example, the state T plus when 2 qubits are excited. And this solid line here is our perturbative result, which is AC Stark shifted from this pointed line here. And this dashed line here is actually our result when we take into account also the counter-rotating term in the coupling to the cavity. So you see this is just a minor difference here. And another property of the AC Stark effect can be exploited when the 2 qubits have different coupling strengths to the cavity, because the 2 qubits can be detuned relatively to each other. And in principle, this actually enables to control the direct coupling of the qubits by the cavity photons, because you can decouple the 2 qubits by detuning them. And so for mathematical easiness, let's assume that one qubit is decoupled and the other one has a finite coupling constant g to the cavity. Then mathematically, the AC Stark shift induces an energy difference between the states up, down, and down, up. And this can be used to control the level of mixing due to J perp. And the AC Stark shift of these, or the relative AC Stark shift of these two states, is mainly given by this expression here. So this means we need a large enough photon number such that this term here is much larger than the coupling J perp. And well, just as a brief idea, so if we have identical qubits, we could think of starting with n photons in the cavity, such that the 2 qubits are decoupled. By q-switching of the cavity, which might be possible by some ways we have considered in our paper, the photons can be extracted, which means that these two states become degenerate. And if you maintain now an empty cavity state for a predetermined time, there will be quantum coherent oscillations between these two states. And so the coupling can then be interrupted by injecting n photons satisfying such an inequality again. And for fidelity of this operation, or for high fidelity of this operation, the switching time should be much larger, should be much faster than the time scale associated with the coupling J perp. And so this is, we have calculated some numbers based on our microscopic calculations for exciton qubits. Yeah, but maybe it's okay. So this is just the switching times you get in picoseconds for excitons in coupled quantum dots, coupled quantum shells of a Cooper pair boxes. And you see, due to the different, mainly because of the different coupling constants due to the cavity, we get different switching times, and the minimum photon numbers also vary correspondingly. And this coupling, this direct coupling in milli electron volts, is what we have estimated in our paper. So this is where these numbers are from. Okay, and before I conclude, let me comment on the cavity-mediated two-qubit gate. So the point I want to make here is that when we have two qubits coupled to a cavity, and we want to perform a gate operation via the cavity-mediated coupling, we should also beware of a direct coupling of two qubits, not via the cavity channel, because this may perturb a gate operation. And so the direct qubit interaction modifies the coupling of the two qubits in two ways. First of all, directly, and second, it modifies the energy levels and therefore modifies the detunings of the two qubit states with respect to the cavity. And therefore, the coupling term is different in presence of finite J-perp. And we have calculated, to give an estimate, we have calculated the gate fidelity of a square root of I-swap gate. And we see that the fidelity follows this cosine behavior, where zeta is just a frequency associated with this matrix element. And so we can expand this cosine. And we see here for small J-perp, we have a correction to the ideal result 1 when we have the ideal switching time of the square root of I-swap gate. And just to give a number, so when you have two Cooper pair boxes in a line resonator, and we consider a minute coupling of 0.1 nanoelectron volts or 0.2 nanoelectron volts, you see that the fidelity actually decreases already by on the order of 10%, meaning that one has to beware of remaining coupling J-perp. So for comparison, the coupling to the cavities, there is an energy scale of 20 nanoelectron volts in this experiment here. Okay, and with this I would like to conclude. So we have provided a Schriefer-Wolf transformation for two coupled qubits interacting with an off-resonant cavity. We have considered identical qubits, which I've shown here, but also more complicated cases. We have also done, which I have not presented here, microscopic calculations of the direct qubit interaction for excitons in quantum dots or quantum shells and capacitively coupled Cooper pair boxes. We have shown that coupled two qubit states can, similarly like single qubit states, read out via the AC Stark effect, which shifts the cavity frequency. And we have also discussed that the direct qubit interaction can be controlled via cavity photons, given that we have different coupling constants to the cavity. And we have also discussed that the direct qubit interaction may affect or perturb the cavity-mediated two-qubit gate. And with this, I thank you for your attention.
Did you take into account the bending of the cavity? Or can you say a few words about that change?
Yes. So in this work, we have not. The coupling to the cavity is usually taken into account with the James-Cummings model. And Alexandre Blais and co-workers, they have actually done some numerical calculations of the damping. And you see that the cavity line is broadened. And as we didn't expect a significant change for our case here, we did not take this into account because we didn't expect anything new. So the damping essentially leads to a broadening of the cavity line.
So this broadening is assumed to be small relative to all other scales?
Actually only small with respect... Okay, in order to measure the effect, for example, the state-dependent splitting of the cavity line, these splittings should be large compared to the damping. But this is similar to the case when you have a single qubit. So because the magnitude of these shifts are given by mainly by the interaction constant to the cavity, G squared, divided by the detuning. And this is the same for the single qubit or the coupled qubit proposal.
Yes.
This is the okay. We have yes. So here we were talking about capacitively coupled Cooper pair boxes, and this is the coupling the capacitive coupling energy. There have been experiments with capacitively coupled Cooper pair boxes where they have demonstrated the quantum coherent oscillations. I haven't put a reference to Pashkin and co-workers. And there they had a coupling which was actually more than 1,000 times larger. So there was deliberate coupling. And here the point I'm trying to make is like even if there is a much, much smaller coupling, there could even be still an effect.
But the coupling is not due to the electron directly
over
there. No. Capacitor.
Exactly, yeah. So for the coupled Cooper pair boxes, we consider yes capacitive coupling which transfers a Cooper pair basically between an excitation between the Cooper pair boxes.
Isn't that G square over delta? Why do you have another term?
Okay, this is the capacitive coupling between the qubits, and this is the AC Stark shift due to the coupling to the cavity. So G is the coupling to the cavity, and delta is the detuning of the qubit frequency and the cavity.
So what is the capacitive?
This can be calculated in a kind of a classical model, having two rectangular plates which interact electrostatically.
Oh, okay. But how does that change?
This is in terms of this model. So it is a pseudo exchange, if you wish. So the capacitive coupling means that it transfers an excitation from one Cooper pair box to the other. It is like a pseudo. Okay. This is different, because then we also have a finite JZ. And this means the detunings are a bit different. Okay, let me come back to this. Okay, so I'm saying that the detunings here will be a bit different. It will not just be given by J per, but also by JZ. Yeah, and then J per is the usual exchange interaction.
When you say you can bring the same qubit out, I see you switch the frequency of the cavity. I mean, in a practical way, if you have a qubit, which is a mixture of the up and down states, I mean, what are you actually measuring the projective measurement of the qubit?
Well,
you send a photon in and...
Yes, you send a photon in, and you want to prepare your qubit in a stationary state.
So it's in some mixture of up and down.
Well, then you get a mixture of the shifts, because this is a second order interaction. This is
not a projection of the state. Okay, so you have shifted the
cavity model. How do I know what the cavity model frequency is? How do I measure it?
Well, this is just by doing spectral analysis, and then in an experiment one would see that the cavity frequency shifts depending on the state of the qubit. And to test this, one would initialize the qubit like in one of the stationary states, not in a superposition. And then one would see the range of the shift, which is G squared over delta.
Okay, but I want to build a quantum computation.
computer, I want to have it in mixture of the two states.
Not for readout.
You said I can read it. How do I actually go about reading it?
I think maybe you are talking about manipulation, because the readout should in the end be like a classical bit sequence, zeros and ones.
I agree, but within a mixture, it should come out. Give me one frequency or another frequency with some probability.
Okay.
Mixture, I need
to make, okay, I understand.
Exactly how I measure the.
Well, I guess the answer. So I guess you're referring to, and let's assume that our computation was not ideal, and we are not, for example, one bit is not in the state 0 or 1, but it is in a superposition. So this means that the line is not shifted by the full Stark shift, but by a combination of them two. So the line would be somewhere in between. So I guess one would need some...
resonated a mixture of the two frequencies, no? Because...
So if you look at the terms of the Stark shift, so they are like in a simple one-qubit model. So they are of the form photon number coupled to sigma z. And so it depends on the qubit state according to sigma z.
The expectation value of sigma z.
Sorry?
The expectation value of sigma z.
Yes. So this is for a single qubit. So that's why the cavity frequency is shifted for a single qubit case. In our case, it is a bit more complicated because it is not sigma z, but it is the projection onto one of these stressed sigma triplet state.
What are you saying is the perturbation that can have continuous range of values depending on what's the position you're preparing, and therefore the shift can change by continuous range. Is that what you're saying?
If the cavity is strictly off-resonant, then yes, because there is no photon absorbed. It's just a virtual two-photon process. Small detuning, yes.
Small detuning,
Well, if you just think about readout, I think that's not something dangerous in that respect, because you want to read out a register of qubits, for example.
Yes, but even if you have a laser, it has also.
Yes, these are.
Which means that when you are either very close,
very small, or whether you have very high power,
yes,
you always get absorption.
Okay, but if the beam profile and the let's say the absorption line width do not overlap, I guess then there's no power dependence because there's no absorption. At low temperatures, of course, when you can exclude phonon processes or higher order processes.
We won't have the tuning large enough that you do not have any absorption.
Mm-hmm, exactly, yeah.
It means that you have to have a higher intensity.
Correspondingly, yes.
It will give you sort of all sorts of parasitic effects, like photon absorption.
It depends on what system you're talking about. The Cooper pair boxes, this can be done because it has been shown experimentally.
I think now of the optical.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So you're thinking of excitons now, for example. Mm-hmm.
Well, since David Avshalom is the co-author, this would be the main model you're thinking about.
Well, I think we were interested in having a kind of a general model because we were interested in making a contribution which are interesting to different communities. But I mean, if you have a continuous wave laser, this can be extremely sharp. Can be maybe micro EVs, I don't know the exact numbers. And so this means you could go pretty close to the absorption lines. That would be
I only know about these experiments they have been doing 10 years ago or so in labs now, and I still remember that in order to get significant shifts, they really had to have full power with the best layers that they had. So it did not struck me as very subtle experiments at that time.
Yeah, what structures were these? I don't remember.
Quantum wells.
Quantum wells, okay. In quantum wells you have a continuum of states. We are talking about quantum dots where we have comparably sharp lines. So the exciton line widths can also be microelectron holes.
Right. So that means they have to be larger.
Exactly, in order to avoid real excitation.
Okay, no further questions. Thank you very much.
Okay.